Hello, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Teachers for Class War. We're on every Monday, 6 to 7, like the guy said. So, you can be streaming us live at freakradio.org or just listening. If at any point in the show today you want to call in, the on-air number is 427-3772. We're going to be talking to Jeff Duncan Andrade, who's been a repeat guest, works for the, Chavez Institute for Social Justice Education. Go ahead.
The Educational Equity Institute.
Thank you.
At San Francisco State University. And also a teacher, and I always forget the name of the school in Oakland. But I would definitely, we are going to put him, try to put him on line two now that there are two lines working, thanks to a particular hardworking collective member.
Woo-hoo.
So we've in the past had him on the show and have just like, you know, blocked off the phone and done an hour with Jeff. And I think it would be cool to have some calls for those of you that have listened in the past or that just want to jump on and have a bit more of a call-in now that we have two functional lines and a repeat guest that's familiar to the show and to the air here. So that number again is 427-FRSC, 427-3772. All right, Jeff, are you there? Can you hear us? Oh, hang on.
I can hear you.
Okay, I gotta hit your mic a little bit. There we go. So basically, The way that I wanted to start off the interview myself is that I've heard you speak a couple of times. We've had you on the air a couple of times. And every time afterwards, I leave feeling really inspired and feeling like, yeah, I could totally use that tip and I can totally use this tip. And similar with my peers, a lot of us feel really, really inspired by what you're doing in your classroom and the types of things that you're studying and putting out in your publications. But the exception or the caveat to that is that a lot of times we feel like it doesn't match our realities in terms of, like, what I understand your setup to be when you're teaching is that you have somewhere around 18, 20, something like that, kids, and you have one cohort that follows you for 3 years. Is that right?
30 kids.
Okay.
And then, yeah, I loop with them.
So for me, I have 240 kids. My smallest class is about 40. And for Ariel, she's got a bunch of, she's got what, 17 or 18? What are her numbers like?
About that, but you know, a smaller number show up and it's a challenge, in terms of consistency and attendance.
Yeah. We have, both of us have sort of this rotating roll sheet where kids are coming in and changing every day. And so I guess, it's not to say that none of your stuff works for us, because a lot of it does. I don't want to be like, you know, oh yeah, that's all fine and good in an ideal world, because that's actually, you know, that's not really the case. A lot of it is super valuable. But the way that we were talking about having this show is like having you address some of the more chaotic elements or some of the less than ideal elements of our teaching jobs.
Okay.
Because Jeff, what we're coming up on here is the beginning of a new school year, right? And this year, to be a public school teacher in California, all the doom and gloom, all the statistics, everything we can look at, and just the situation that we're finding in the classrooms is we're really pulling together every resource we can to make it work in what looks like the worst year to be a public school teacher anyone's seen. So we talked about some of the challenges, and you know, I sent you a bit of a note just saying that when you don't have the administrative support and you don't have the resources, and to be honest, it's been that way for a long time. We haven't come to expect them even, but this year is just even cut on top of a cut and worse than ever.
Right.
So my main question then is that when you're in that situation and you know it, how do you start the year off? How do you set the tone with your students that you're, you know, in a totally new environment, and how do you make it, how do you explain that to the kids, or how do you set yourself up in a place where you might really only have control over your very own classroom and your very own group of kids and nothing else?
Well, I guess that's the way I always feel. So, you know, in many ways, the advantage to working in communities where resources have always been scarce is that I'm not really any more concerned with the situation right now than I usually am when the school year starts, because you can't really take away resources from places that don't have any to begin with. And, you know, I'm not trying to diminish the severity of the situation that we're facing in schools, because, you know, it may indeed be the most dire, but it's relative, right? And I feel like my experience is that we've been working under dire straits for quite some time. So I wouldn't want to underestimate our capacity to be resilient, and I think that I draw most of my strength from my students and the fact that as bad as things may be for us, they've been worse for them for quite some time. So I'm not spending much time kind of wallowing in my own evaluation of why things are worse for me right now. I think things probably are worse for teachers right now, but they're nowhere near as bad as they are for the young people. And the young people show up anyway. And that's my source of strength and inspiration, that they come anyway. No matter how bad it might be, whether you're talking about the political climate, the economic climate, the social climate, or just the kinds of social trauma that they're experiencing in their own lives, they come anyway. And for me, that's a profoundly hopeful thing. So, you know, if you work in schools like the ones that I work in East Oakland, they're every day, every year, there is something that you can look at that would suggest that there's very little reason to be optimistic every day. And I'm not optimistic. I kind of take Cornel West's position on this one, where I'm not optimistic. I haven't had an optimistic day in my teaching life. But I am hopeful. And I think that's an important distinction to make, particularly in these troubling times, that, you know, optimism is when you evaluate the existing conditions, and then based on that evaluation, you believe things are going to get better. And I'm not optimistic, but, you know, when I evaluate the conditions, there's nothing based on my evaluation that makes me believe that things are getting better. Quite the contrary, my evaluation leads me to believe that things are getting worse and going to keep getting worse. But optimism and hope are not the same thing. Hope is when you evaluate the existing conditions and you think things are going to get better anyway. And I am hopeful, and I'm not, you know, I've written recently about these kind of distinctions that I make in hope, and I think there's forms of false hope that teachers can get caught up in, like, oh, well, you know, we have a black president now, so, and I work with black students, so, you know, I could be hopeful behind that. I call that hokey hope, right, and I call that false hope. I have more of a critical hope, and that critical hope really comes from the incredible resiliency that I see in the students and the families and the communities that have been suffering long before this so-called economic collapse. That is really you're seeing punish a middle class or a relative middle class that hasn't really experienced some of the suffering that they're experiencing right now, but that poor folks have been experiencing for quite some time. So when I look at my students and the fact that they've been really finding ways to be hopeful and resilient for years now and generations in many of our communities where these conditions have been really dire, then I kind of turn away from the bleaker part of the picture or the analysis which might lead me to have a bleak outlook on things. And also, again, I'm rejuvenated again to say that, you know, we'll make it through this too. And in terms of how I talk to my students, I think that I like being the underdog. And I like it when the odds are stacked against us. And so I see it, you know, I start teaching a group of ninth graders on August 31st, and that's going to be, you know, one of the main messages out of my mouth on day one is that now is the time when you really find out what a community is made of. It's not during the flush times, and now is the time when you really find out what teachers are made of. It's not in the flush times. It's when you're really up against it is where you really find out about who the teachers and who the community members are that are in solidarity and who's out for themselves. And I'm actually kind of excited about this year because there's a real there's a really real rallying point around which I expect to have even stronger relationships with my students because we're going to need each other, and we're going to need each other's families. We're going to need each other's resources. We're going to need each other's strength. We're going to need each other in ways that perhaps in the past we may not have. So, you know, and part of that may just be my personality that I embrace struggle, and I don't want to struggle like I never would like to just, you know, on cruise control. But, you know, I don't live in that world, and I'm kind of excited about the potential to really do some critical work with my students in a way that that generates a level of collectivity and solidarity that in more flush times might be a little harder to come by, although I reiterate what I said in the beginning, which is that, there has not been a year in the 18 years that I've been in the classroom where this situation has not been extremely dire.
So how can we build that solidarity, that sense that we're going to need each other when
each other changes daily?
Well, one, when each other changes daily, and two, when the kids in the classroom are looking at you like, what are you going to do for me? And when the kids in the classroom have issues with each other where they don't see each other on the same team per se, and they don't see you as being on the same team, and how does it come to the point, how can you get the perspective out there and create that environment when all in it together is really us, teachers and students together?
Well, and ditto parents, like parents not seeing each other on the same team. So for example, in our community, it's like new immigrants versus folks who have immigrated several generations ago with a lot of tension between them and not a lot of time. Like with the kids, I don't really have so much of a problem with the kids because, you know, we can talk about that with them. It just takes a little while to break that down. But with parents too, and getting the community to really come together around this classroom, you know, how do you work with the wider community, like parents as well as the kids?
So there's a bunch of questions embedded in
sorry.
So I'll start with the first one about what happens when you have kids coming in and out or what have you. I mean, we all have transients in our classrooms based on any number of things. It could be things going on in kids' lives. It could be just dysfunction at the school. And I think that the levels vary. So I don't want to minimize how a classroom where that is really intense and where there's a constant circulation of students in and out, how that undermines that project. I think in that condition, that I would be thinking about this project as something that is bigger than my classroom. So, you know, for lack of a better word, club or after school program that extends, where membership extends beyond you're in my second period class, and that it's really about being a member of some, right, some deeper set of activities, whether or not you're in second period anymore or not. And I think that my advice to teachers is always to move on the field of dreams model, which is if you build it, they will come. And you can get hung up all day on, well, this kid just left my class and this kid. What I ask teachers, well, what are you doing, right? So, okay, so you can't get all 240 kids. Can you get 10? Can you just get 10? And then when you get 10, what's your plan to go to 15? And when you get 15, what's your plan to get? So I think people always think in terms of like a single kid or in terms of all the kids. And both of those, I think, are bankrupt strategies because you're never going to get them all, but you should try. So I've never batted 1,000, but I expect to every year. And then you can get this really myopic view where you're only dealing with one kid. And then, of course, that's a largely exclusionary model, right? So I think that my advice to teachers is to figure out what you can bite off and chew, and investment at that level, and then push yourself and figure out how you can expand your capacity to 15 or 20 or 25 or 100 or whatever it is. And I think that through that you can, you get two things that I think make the work more sustainable. One, you get a clear sense of affirmation and a clear sense of success with a pocket of kids that you're heavily investing in. And you know, not all 240 kids or however many kids you have. Like when I was teaching full time, I had well over 160. I couldn't make that kind of intense investment in all 160 every single day. You don't need to. Mm-hmm. Like, what you need to set up is the structure where they can access that intense investment when they need it. And some days it's really like it's really heavy, and you may not be able to meet the mark. It may be, you know, 30 kids on that day really need some intense support and care and love and blah blah blah, and you've only got the gas for 24, and on that day you come up short, and it's not good enough. And if you're critical and you're self-reflective, then, you know, whatever, you'll do some more push-ups that night, and the next time that comes up, you'll get to 27. But, so I think but what that does for you is it creates a consistent form of affirmation that you're impacting kids' lives, which I think is important for the kind of, you know, sustaining oneself in this work. Now, with respect to, well, so how do you get kids to sort of buy into this, and when you've got this animosity, so, you know, you've got these tensions that are working at two levels. You've got the tensions that are working at the classroom or at the youth level, and then you've got the tensions that are working beyond the classroom and the youth level, at the adult level and the community level. And I don't think the project is necessarily mutually exclusive, although I think there's times when you have separate battle plans, if you will, or separate sets of strategies. So I can articulate those separately, but in my own mind, it's often there's a lot of overlap. And so it's when I talk about these things, I want folks to understand that I'm talking about them in as though they're separate, when in my own mind and my own work, they're really not. Right, they're interwoven, and there's a lot of overlap. So, with the kids, I think that early in my career, I said all those things I said at the beginning of this session, and I meant it. And then I had to go about proving it every day. And there's no shortcut to that. There's no shortcuts to trust. And, you know, I think a lot of teachers want trust de facto, and it just doesn't work that way, especially not in communities where the institutions have historically and present day continue to violate the social compact between the institution and the young person or the institution and the family. And we're part of that system, right? I mean, we can, you know, distance ourselves from the state budget all we want. We are state employees. So we're wrapped up in the cause of the crisis from the perspective of a young person. Whether we like it or not, it doesn't really matter, right? You don't have to like somebody's assessment of you. It is what it is. And so I feel like, you know, when I first started teaching, I went in and I was aware of that. I knew the history. I had done my research. I knew the history of schools in my community, and so I knew where I stood based on my title, and I knew that every day I had to prove that I was not my title, that I was the kind of teacher that I always wanted growing up and never had. And that can be really frustrating when you are, you know, when you're really putting in the work and you're really committed, and kids aren't necessarily buying in, and they're, you know, or they may even be undermining. And I think that the part of that project is being able to understand without accepting where that resistance is coming from, and to understand that resistance from young people is a good thing. And that our job is not to smash the resistance. Our job is to cultivate it and redirect it in a way such that, as Dennis Lozano and Dolores Delgado Bernal talk about in their work, such that it is transformative resistance. But I think a lot of teachers feel that resistance from kids, and they think that's a bad thing. And I see it as an opportunity. So when kids are rolling their eyes or whatever, for me, that's a challenge. right? It's a challenge to really prove to them that what I'm saying is true. And I'm going to live up to that even if you don't. And I'm going to live up to that until you do. And that's, in my mind, that's what Tupac meant when he talked about unconditional love. And you know, there's a number of, I think, places in our lives where, if we're really reflective, we see the way that other people have given us that unconditional love, even when we were returning it, whether it's in our relationship with our partner, or whether it's in our relationship with our parents, or whether it's in a relationship with a mentor or a close friend or whatever. And I think that's what I try to model with my students, is I don't expect anything in return. And for that reason, I think that it comes, right? Because I'm not expecting it. And when it doesn't, then I don't resent that. I just feel like I got to work harder to earn that respect and that return on the unconditional love that I'm putting out. And it's funny because, you know, I've been talking to a lot of teachers lately as we start ramping up from the summer to get into the school year. And there's been one constant in my life as a teacher it's really been amazing. And I don't know if I'm just lucky or if it's factual. I don't have any scientific data to prove that this is like true for all teachers. But when I am at my lowest point, it has always happened in my career that a child from either my past or my present group senses that and reminds me why I teach.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what I tell teachers is, if you just keep battling, then it'll come, that text, that Facebook message, that phone call, that, you know, classroom visit, that whatever green apple that you really don't want to eat, but the kid brings you away, to affirm that you're doing the right thing. And, you know, my advice to teachers is model the resiliency that you see in the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Keep battling, and the community will affirm you. And I think that what happens a lot is that people lose faith in the community. And they lose faith in the kids. And they lose faith that kids in the community really see the value and the effort that teachers are putting forward. And that hasn't been my experience. And it doesn't always come when I want it. But it always seems to get there when I need it.
Yeah, now, agreed. I think it's definitely, I mean, I think that, I hope I can say that all three of us definitely feel that our students, you know, for the, by and large, are very much bought in, and parents, you know, when I call up to say your kid was a shithead today, they usually say thank you. So yeah, that definitely rings true for me.
Right. But, you know, I think now, later in my career, it operates very differently. And I think there's something to be said for this as well, that early career teachers need to hear from veteran teachers, and that veteran teachers could do better in taking advantage of it. So now when I start class, so for example, on the 31st, when my class starts with these ninth graders who I haven't met, and you know, a few of them might know me from my reputation in Oakland, most don't. When that class starts, second period, that room will be packed with my former students. So I call my former students, I text them, I Facebook them, I email them, and I say, I need you at 9:10 a.m. at Fremont High School in East Oakland in room 1121. And I pack that room with students that are in their late 20s, and we'll just say that's my oldest student, just I'll have to overdate myself, and students that are 18 that just graduated from my class.
Yeah.
And so I'll introduce the class, and I'll talk a little about what we're going to do. Then I walk out, and I let my former students talk to my new students. My new students talk to my former students. And what I tell students is that I want you to talk to yourself in ninth grade. This is a chance for you to talk to you. When you're in ninth grade and you are walking into my class, and what would you tell yourself? What would you do differently? What would you do all over again if you could? And then when I start talking about solidarity and community and collectivity and unconditional love, my new students, it's confirmed from day one that this is for real. Because what I tell my students on day one is I'm going to be in your life forever. And there's moans and groans about that. But because, you know, they're in ninth grade, and that's what they do. But then I walk out, and I let the proof speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's no doubt, right? Because I've got kids in there who, you know, have been to jail, have babies, didn't make it through my class and had to come back late, et cetera. It's like the whole gambit, right, of kids that are, and kids who were, you know, the apple of my eye for the entire time they were with me and you know, graduated from college and are now doctors.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the whole gambit in there, and the experience for them is all very much the same in terms of affirming the fact that, look, it is for real. What he says is for real. Like, he's really in your life forever.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what happens, he'll never quit on you. And he's going to be really hard on you. And he's going to be really tough on you. And he's never going to accept mediocrity from you. And the reason for that is because he loves you. And I can do that. And it will have a different impact than if somebody from their block, from their community, from their apartment building, from their housing project, from their family, actually says that because they've experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what teachers should work toward, is forming those kind of relationships with, you know, groups of students year after year, maintaining those relationships, and then using those relationships as they build another generation of students that they're working with, rather than feeling like they have to start from scratch, you know, each time that they get a new list of students for a new school year.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I appreciate that.
We're speaking with Jeff Duncan Andrade. He's a teacher, a high school teacher in East Oakland, as well as a teacher of teachers at the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State. The teachers for Class War here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, ordinarily have a third and fourth host in the room with us. So it's just the two of us this evening. So Jeff, if it's all right with you, one of the things we wanted to do is open up the other phone line to calls. We have improved the tech here a little bit since you and I last talked about the disaster in the phone lines, and now have the ability to get other folks on the air. And so if it's all right with you, I wanted to encourage our listeners to call in.
That'd be great.
With other questions and such. So that number is 427-3772. 427-FRSC, if you're listening online, of course, then it's an 831 area code in advance.
So the next question, I was just going to switch gears a little bit and go back to sort of antagonistic and dysfunctional district, union, administration, and whatnot. Because I think that of the teachers in the collective, we're pretty bought into the stuff that's been said in terms of just getting by and showing love and really, really deeply being there for our students. So the question is, do you really bother with working on the sort of higher levels of administration and whatnot?
Well, I hope my wife doesn't listen to this show. No, I don't. But I think that work needs to be done. And, you know, my wife does a lot of work in policy, and so we have this internal debate in our house all the time about, you know, does policy really matter? And of course, I think policy matters. It's just not the work I'm going to do. And I think that the Confucius saying here is applicable, that there are many paths all leading home. And And, you know, the German philosopher Goethe put it another way when he said, there is my way, there is your way, but there is not the way. So I can offer you my perspective on it, but I don't think I'm right in the sense that there's only one way. I have chosen to really focus my energy on the classroom because I feel like it is something that I want to master and that it's really hard to master. And so if you're spending time working, you know, whatever, at the higher levels of administration, whatever, however you might conceptualize that, then it's time you're not working on your classroom.
Definitely.
Right? Because, right, there's a finite number of hours in the day. I think if you're going to work at the administrative level, then you should work at the administrative level. And I think that what I've been able to do, that my, you know, maybe this is some doublespeak, but what I've been able to do is to strike a marriage where I'm able to influence that level of thinking because of my degree, because I have a PhD, and it's one of the reasons why my homie and one of the best teachers I've ever seen in Oakland, a guy named Ernest Morrell, mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why we went and got our doctorate. We felt like we were having some pretty consistent success in the classroom, but then we were watching our students, you know, experience this institution that was really callous and uncaring, and we ended up feeling like we were undoing a lot of the damage that was done when they weren't with us. And that's not to say there weren't other good teachers there, or counselors, or administrators, because there were, but generally speaking, right, the institution is a beast. And so we said, well, we want to be able to impact it at a deeper level. And I would argue that that the jury's out on my work there. I mean, if I don't get my PhD, I'm probably not on this program. If I don't get my PhD, I'm, you know, we probably never meet. I probably don't write a lot of the stuff that folks have read. So, if you describe the level administrative work as influencing teacher professional development,
mm-hmm.
teacher development, principal development, district-wide assessment strategies, et cetera, you know, district-wide policy on discipline, then yeah, I think it's possible, but you have to rethink your teacher role. So, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of the session, I'm not a full-time teacher.
Right.
I'm a full-time university faculty member. I'm actually a volunteer teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't get paid to teach high school. I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I reconceptualize my role as a teacher. And there's no clean pathway for that. And I think that's part of the problem, is that you have to really be willing to think outside of the box. You got to be willing to take some risks. But it's definitely possible where you can, you know, you can split a day,
mm-hmm.
where you have a half day. You're in the classroom, and a half day you might, you know, be doing some other kind of project where you are perhaps influencing, you know, new teacher induction, or, you know, whatever, teacher training classes at a local university, or I think there's a million different ways that you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's important that you have, so, you know, I have a very strategic and deliberate plan around it, right? I'm not making it up as I go along. I have a very clear vision about how I want to stay connected to the classroom, but also how I want to use my degree to influence some of these higher level discourses that a traditional classroom teacher may not get access to. So at that level, I think if you have a very clear plan about how you want to go about doing it, then I think it can be a very productive use of your time.
That makes sense.
You have a grounded perspective, right? You've been in the classroom.
Right, and you know where you're going, and you have a specific achievable goal, as opposed to just sort of blindly stabbing at the beast and
you know, getting frustrated. So we do have somebody on the line. It sounds like it's another one of our collective members.
Yeah, it's the third host. So.
Oh, sorry about that. So, hi, Jeff. This is Ariel, I'm another teacher for Class War. But I'm at home today with a sick baby. So my question is a pretty different topic than what you've been talking about. And so I've been teaching for, 4 years now, and the first few years that I was teaching, I felt like I was able to dedicate pretty much all of my energy towards my students and towards you know, giving them extra attention out of class, and then just time investment, you know. And now that I have a son and I'm also teaching, I feel like I have much more defined boundaries of what I can do with my time.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working on trying to maintain that balance. And I was wondering if you have any advice for teachers who are, you know, like I work at a continuation high school with students that I could, that I feel really passionately about supporting and working with to the degree that I'm most capable to do. But, but I have a son waiting for me at daycare, and it's this big struggle. And I was wondering if you've worked with any teachers who have been able to kind of maintain that level of commitment that you're talking about and also had families.
So, yes, I see teachers with families do it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's funny you use the word balance because I just wrote a piece a group of teachers read about that very question, because I get to ask that question all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you maintain balance, right?
Yeah.
And I think that so I encourage you to read that piece. It's in the, I don't know if you all are familiar with the group ADE? ADE, Association of Raza Educators.
Okay.
So anyway, they have a journal that they just started putting out, and I wrote an open letter to teachers about that exact question.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so this idea of balance. And I think that, you know, different teachers are asking that question for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the answer is always needs to be nuanced and specific to, you know, that individual person's needs and concerns. But I think about that question with respect to my parents,
mm-hmm.
right? And so my parents raised 7 kids.
Wow.
And as far as I know, right, they never worried about balance,
mm-hmm.
right? It wasn't a question they really asked themselves or us, or, you know, whoever. And the reason for that was because it was what they signed up for. And so when raising us, right, was what they signed up for, that we're going to have a big family, and that's going to be insane, it's going to be crazy, it's going to be chaotic, and that's what it's going to be like. And I actually wondered about that once around my mother. And my mother said, and this is hella funny because I actually saw this line many years later. My mom's response, I actually saw that her exact response many years later on the movie Gladiator. I said, I don't know what that means, but so what my mom said when I wondered, my parents, like, they never had anything for themselves, right? They never had new clothes. It seemed like they never had time. They never had nothing, right? Everything went to us. And when I wondered about that once, my mom said to me, sometimes I do what I want to. The rest of the time, I do what I have to. And the more I reflected on that as I started thinking about how to respond to teachers that asked me that question, I think about it in the same way that, and it goes back to, I don't know if you heard my earlier comments about when I've reached my lowest point.
Yeah, then somebody brings it back up. Yeah.
And I think that my belief about balance And what I've seen teachers with families do that have been able to maintain these incredible commitments to their students in the community, that balance is not a gift you give yourself. Mm-hmm. Balance is a gift bestowed to you by the people who you serve. And so in those moments when my parents were going down, right, because they were quote unquote out of balance. They were exhausted, they were sick, they were whatever. We saw it as their children, right? We saw it. And we intervened, and we said, no, Mom, stay in bed. We'll cook dinner today. We'll clean the house. We'll pick up the slack. And that's where my mom got her balance, right, was from us recognizing her incredible commitment to us and stepping in that key moment when she was bottoming out and she really needed us, and that's where she was rejuvenated. But her willingness to go that far for us is also why we love her so much. Mm-hmm. Because her love for us is unconditional and you can't doubt it, right? Now, the second piece with your case specifically, what I would add to that, because I don't know if that even necessarily applies to your situation, but with respect to, right, your new child, and what I've seen teachers do, particularly with their, and I think it's, I'm the youngest of the seven, so I got the polished parenting skills, mm-hmm. right? And I think, you know, with what I've seen with, you know, especially a lot of my homies that I'm very close with, and I've seen them have, with their first kid, it's like, right, you're learning. Right? You're like a first-year teacher.
Yeah, totally.
Wait, right? It's super more serious, right?
And something that's actually been really interesting and actually kind of supporting me at school is, you know, one of the students in my homeroom has a 2-month-old son. It gives us this, you know, we're talking about what our babies are doing in our absence, you know, together.
Right. Exactly where I was going to go, mm-hmm. which is that I think one of the mistakes teachers make is they try to draw this professional boundary line between their home life and the school life or the community. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're working in the communities like the ones where we work, that line doesn't work. It might make sense in the suburbs where kids have, you know, much more stable home conditions and, you know, the resources are there and et cetera, and they may not need the kind of intensity of additional adult investment that is often required of teachers that are working in high poverty communities or urban communities. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you try to separate that out, right, where you draw these very clear distinctions between, well, this is my home life and this is my life with my new baby and then this is my teaching life, then teaching is now a job. Mm-hmm. And jobs have hours. And you punch in and you punch out and it changes your relationship to the work inevitably. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that you will always side with home, mm-hmm. if home is a distinct place from where you do your work as a teacher. And the teachers that I've seen do it the most effectively, they blur that line. And so the community is raising their child as much as they are raising the children in the community. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, this idea that you're kind of like swapping strategies with one of your students, mm-hmm. is precisely what I see highly effective teachers do that are dealing with these an additional set of responsibilities in their life, whether it's a partner who's you know, demanding more from them, or whether it's a new child in their family or whatever. I think that you can ask for things from your students when you have these additional responsibilities that are sort of weighing on you. And I have always been wonderfully surprised at how students will step up, mm-hmm. to support teachers that they know really care about them and have stepped up for them in the past to honor that need that you have, in the same way that we stepped up from my mom or my pops when they were, you know, really struggling to get through some stuff to make sure that they got through it.
Yeah,
so I
guess,
think it goes back to that.
What I'm working on is not getting to that point of being, you know, being laid out in bed and having people to like step up and take care of me. I'm trying to avoid the like, you know, spread so thin that I crash mode. You know.
Yeah, but I think that extreme times demand extreme measures. Mm-hmm. Right? You're not working in conditions of moderation. Right, you're working in some of the most dire, as was said at the beginning of the show, right? It may be more dire now than ever. And, you know, that's the reality of, I think we work so hard in this country to avoid really staring down the reality of what we're dealing with. We are in a crisis. And comfort goes away during crisis. The only people who look to maintain comfort during crisis are people who are not experiencing the crisis. And I think that, you know, that's the reality of what we're dealing with right now. And we can duck it and we can dodge it and we can, you know, try to find this you know, the more comfortable spot in the rock bed. Or we can, you know, as James Baldwin said, you know, that we can look the principal facts of our lives in the face. And I think that's the reality of what we're dealing with right now. Not only in our schools, but in our larger right social framework, that things, as Achebe said, things are starting to fall apart. Mm-hmm. Right, the center cannot hold, and I think that it's in those times where we've got to be willing to meet these extreme conditions with some pretty extreme commitments. And my experience has always been that when we meet the community there, they'll protect us. And it may not be when we want it. Right? I think that's the important point to make here. It may not come when you want it, but if you maintain that faith and that hope, that real critical hope in the community, my experience with teachers all over the country is that they're always protected, and they're always taken care of at those moments when they need it the most.
Yep. Yeah, I'm definitely, like, I feel like we've only been teaching for, like, 2 weeks now, and I feel like I'm lucky enough to have very small classes and be able to build really intimate relationship with these students and be able to go so much deeper than I would be able to in a normal public school environment because it's a continuation school. And I see a lot of potential for all the things that we can do together this year. And I should probably say that we should open up this phone line so other people can call in and ask you questions as well.
Okay. So. Well, thank you and congratulations.
Oh, thank you. And it's good talking to you. And enjoy the rest of the show. Bye.
Thanks.
Okay, so the phone lines are back open if anybody wants to call during the last few minutes of the show. In the meantime, Jeff, I would ask you, I mean, we only have a couple minutes left, so we'll see how this goes, but I wonder how much stock you put in public schools. There's a lot of talk about charter schools. There's a lot of people deserting and even in bad economic times going to private schools. My boyfriend and I, who's also a teacher, sometimes fantasize about starting our own school. We've both worked in private schools and see that sometimes private schools are run so much more smoothly and efficiently. And yet we both have come to a point where we've returned to to public schools because that's who we want to be with. We want to be with that population of kids. And yet I feel like the Titanic is just sinking deeper and deeper, and it's time to start building little like life rafts out of the remnants, or I don't really know what metaphor to use, but like, how much stock do you...
The institution is a beast was a good metaphor.
Well, yeah, but I mean, also the institution is like bleeding us dry. So while we can create these really beautiful life-affirming classrooms, I'm looking at the system as a whole just thinking, you know, they're just going to keep on reaming us. At what point do we start building alternative systems, and what are those alternative and autonomous systems look like? So is that something you buy into at all, or how do you see that? Yep, we might have lost Jeff's call.
Oh.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, did you get to hear that question?
No, I didn't.
Well, the listeners did. Sorry, listeners. Okay, so basically the question was this. There's a lot of we're losing buy-in to public schools on a national level. There's a lot of talk about charter schools. There's a lot of talk about private schools. People are deserting public schools for private schools, even in bad economic times. Some of us as teachers are, you know, fantasizing about sort of building alternate structures because we see that the structure of public school is just getting bled dry. And, you know, just if it keeps getting worse and worse and worse, yes, we can build these beautiful classroom environments, but how can we start to envision a future that's not quite as dependent on this beast of public schools that keeps hurting us?
Yeah, it's a question I often run through in my own mind. And as was the case with my previous response, I'm never convinced that I'm right. But I'm not willing to give up on the public schools right now. And as I said in some of my earlier comments, I tend to get the most motivated and the most and really thrive in at the lowest moments. Mm-hmm. and when everybody's doubting, right? And I think you're right. That's a pretty accurate assessment that public support of public schools is dwindling fast. And insert, right, all the kind of pariahs and corporate, whatever you want to call them, do-gooders and all these other things that are attempting to fill this void that they in some ways created themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it just motivates me even more, you know, that I'm eternally critically hopeful. And the more that the odds stack up, the more I feel like the more certain I am that we're fighting the right fight. That said, I think that and most of the reason why I say that is because we're paying for these institutions. If suddenly we didn't have to pay taxes anymore, I might have a different opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see that anywhere in the near future. So, you know, these are our institutions. And so I'm not willing to just concede them. You know, I'm going to fight for these spaces. And I think that that's one reason why the trajectory that I'm on with some of the work that I'm doing is really invigorating, because I'm able to fight in ways that I think and position myself in ways that I wasn't able to when I was a full-time teacher. It's a trip, because I'm saying the same things I was saying. And when I was saying them when I was teaching first through sixth period, people thought I was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And now people put me on radio shows. And
before you were idealistic and a loose cannon, and now you're a PhD and a published author.
And so now I'm like, right, I'm brilliant, I'm insightful, and it's like
before you were just crazy,
you, right? it's funny because it's some of the same people. I mean, literally the same people,
right?
And they think I forgot about them, and I'm like, no, I remember exactly what you used to tell me. Well, I used to say the same thing, but you just, you know, saw me as some whatever, you know, regular high school teacher. So, whatever. I think that I have a little bit different insight than I had when I was teaching full time as a high school teacher into the kind of inroads that we can make, right? And it's really rewarding to be able to go into a school and do a PD and really see teachers feel affirmed and have, you know, an ongoing multi-year relationship with those teachers off of one PD, where, you know, they come and see my classroom and I go and see their classroom and we have phone conversations and we meet for coffee. And that gives me a sense of hope in the public school system that I think a lot of people who are in it day to day, 8 to
you know, 8 to whatever, don't necessarily get to see. And so I encourage folks to, you know, I think programs like this are really special and unique in that they affirm your descent, right, in ways that if you're just stuck inside of the beast all the time, your descent can kind of diminish because you start, it beats you down. I mean, that's part of the role of the beast, right?
Mm-hmm.
All that said, I'm not against so-called alternative spaces. I think the problem is that, you know, to run those kind of spaces, you need resources.
Right.
And if you're going to be serving communities that don't have a lot of those fiscal, and when I say resources, I mean, you know, concretely, you need fiscal resources.
Yeah, I mean, you need a building.
Right, you need a building.
Any number of things.
Right, you need to be able to pay for heat and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and running water, you know, garbage collection.
Right, it's not cheap.
Right, and I feel like we have created a set of public institutions that are supposed to provide a set service by the law. Well, it's actually technically not by the law, since public education is not in the Constitution. But whatever, right, there are these existing public institutions that are funded by public dollars that are supposed to be providing those services. So if the vision is to move away from that into these more autonomous institutions, then I want to hear as part of that plan, how are we going to acquire the resources mm-hmm. that we have given to the state and make those our resources for those institutions? Because if we can't, I don't see it as a viable project, short of us all suddenly finding some rich member of our family that we didn't know about.
Right, which is also not sustainable. So yeah, I get your point.
Right. So I don't know. I mean, I feel that argument. I hella do, and sometimes I'm definitely more enticed by it than other times.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal position on it is that number one, I believe we can win the fight for good public schools.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have dedicated so many years of my life to it if I didn't fundamentally believe that at my core.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and one of the reasons why I think that that's possible is because I believe that the X factor in schools is the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen so many good teachers in my travels around the world looking at schools and teachers, that I believe, and I've seen them come in so many different shapes and sizes and from different backgrounds and different kind of, you know, trajectories and trainings, that I really believe that we can create fundamentally quality public schools and accomplish that by really investing the way we think about. And I've talked about this on a previous show, that I think that the real attack point for us should be thinking about teachers on three levels. Thinking about really fundamentally changing in our profession how we talk about teacher recruitment.
Right.
Who gets recruited, when they get recruited, where they get recruited, how they get recruited. I think we need to fundamentally rethink teacher training pre-service. So move to a multi-year apprenticeship model
mm-hmm.
where teachers are paired with true master pedagogues, not somebody who just has X number of years in and so they get a small stipend for being a quote-unquote
right.
master teacher. And then rethink teacher professional support and development to include more mainstreaming access to this kind of discourse,
mm-hmm.
and less of the kind of corporate PD, right, textbook-driven type of PD.
Right.
I have seen enough evidence in my work to, at each of those three levels, that I believe that those can happen.
because I've seen it in pockets in certain regions. And the problem is there's no national discourse where somebody in Santa Cruz can hear about how they're doing that in the south side of Chicago. And I also think that's changing.
That was going to be one of the other questions I was going to ask about. It's just, I mean, you talked about RA, and we know about Teachers for Social Justice, which the conference I know is coming up in October. But, yeah, what other forums are there? I mean, you're in the Harvard Educational Review, right? I mean, like, how many of us are actually reading that in our spare time? So
right.
What is there that bonds all of us together?
You mean you guys don't read Harvard Ed in your spare time?
I don't know, man. I'm thinking about taking up subscription now.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, I don't think that's what the answers... The answers don't really lie in the research journals too often. I think what I've seen... It's trip, because I've seen in the last... probably the last 5 years, a major shift. That I never experienced when I was... full-time classroom teaching. So just the idea of a group, Teachers for Social Justice, is nothing like that existed. You know, I don't know how long they've been around, but, I mean, they're on the map, right? And 5 years ago, there was nothing like that.
Right,
there might have been some teachers getting together or whatever, right? But not where they have, like 1,000 people coming out for a freaking free conference, right? I experienced nothing. That is fundamentally hopeful to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? So in to that list I would add, there's a group called Ed for Liberation. They're a national group. They have a cool website. You can Google them out. And they have a national conference every year that I would now I have to be honest, I have not been to their conference, but I have close friends whose work I really respect, who are excellent classroom teachers, who do go every year, and who have said that their conference is the best one we've been to anywhere. And it rotates city to city. It was just in Houston last year, and the conference was called Free Minds, Free People.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to Teachers for Social Justice. It's teacher-run, teacher-driven, and it is packed every year. So the onset of groups like that, right, you have radical math educators, I think it's called Radical Math. It's an organization of so-called radical math teachers. So the growth of these kinds of groups, which are largely organic, largely community emergent, for me suggests a shift in the way that teachers are thinking about themselves. And the reason for this is actually, you can find the reason for this in research journals. That a couple years ago, the National Council for Teaching released a report which said that over the next 10 years, the nation would have to hire at least 1 million new teachers. And the reason for this is because in our profession, and this includes university faculty, by the way, tends to hire in waves. We're a generational hiring profession. So the last big hiring wave came right around the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those folks are aging out of the profession. So what I see both at the university level and at the K-12 level is this massive new wave of teachers. And new teachers tend to bring with them new energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're seeing in these new groups. Now, this is why I'm hopeful about public schools. And if you call me again in 10 years, I will be certain about where my allegiances lie.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're either going to get it right or we're going to get it wrong with this next massive wave of teachers. If we get it right, there is nothing that the quote-unquote beast can do, because we'll overwhelm it. We will have the numbers en masse of public school teachers with a totally different kind of operating framework.
Mm-hmm.
Or we won't. If we get it wrong, then we will see very much the same kind of public schooling system for the next 30 to 35 years as this next wave settles in and becomes the next professional, right, tidal wave of teachers
that will maintain some kind of status quo.
Mm-hmm.
The question for me is not whether or not that will happen. The question for me is, how will that group define normal? And if this shift towards these growing numbers of teachers and these growing numbers of grassroots organizations that are teacher-driven is in any kind of indication about where we're headed, then it's more hopeful now looking down the road than what I see looking backwards.
Yeah, hell yeah. And I would say another thing that really encourages me is that all of these new teachers are intentionally entering into a system that they know is completely devoid of resources. And so
It's
basically selecting for the most radical people possible, because teachers aren't coming into it thinking, you know, oh, my biggest reasons for coming in are, yeah, you know, June, July, and August. It's like, no, I mean to be here and I know it's going to be tough and, you know, really sink in. So, yeah, I would agree with you about being hopeful on that.
The other possibility is that they are, that we have a massive wave of people who are fundamentally insane.
Which is a distinct possibility.
Right? Either of those two might be something to hope for.
In an insane world, right, who's really sane?
Exactly.
So, but yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think that's one of the reasons why when I hear that kind of that push to bail out on the public schools and really start trying to find these more autonomous, school models, whatever term you want to use for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not ready to go there yet. I'm not dismissive of those ideas, but I'm just not ready to go there yet because I don't have in my mind any very concrete strategy for how we would get the material resources to pull that off in a way that gives the community the kind of quality education they deserve.
Well, and like you said, if we can put resources and energy towards retention and recruitment and a modified teacher ed for all these new teachers coming up and then some legitimate professional development that they have a stake in and some control in, then the future looks, all of a sudden the future's looking up, which I didn't think we were going to get to by the end of the interview.
Yeah.
But we have to leave it at that. That's a great spot to finish thinking about.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the air again. I really appreciate your participation in our little project and donation of all your hours. It's really great.
No doubt. Anytime. I look forward to the next time. And I my final words to the listening audience will be open invitation to anybody who wants to come and watch us, you know, do our thing in East Oakland, second period every day. Fremont High School, the small school is called Mandela High School. You can email me anytime, and open invite to any of the listeners to come and check us out anytime.
Right on. You wanna do you really want to give your email address on the air, or should we let them look you up?
I don't mind giving it on the air. It's my first initial J, and then my last name Andrade, Andrade, @sfsu.edu. Or you can just Google search my name and my email will pop up on our either the Institute website, the Cesar Chavez Institute, or the university website.
Right on, Jeff. And are you also going to be at Teachers for Social Justice this year?
I probably will. Karen's about to just hit me up about maybe doing a session. So, I'm sure I'll probably be there and one of the people who's had the biggest influence on my thinking around all this stuff is the keynote this year, Pedro Noguera. So I encourage everybody to come out and hear him as well.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to that too. All right, well, we'll let you go, and thanks again.
Thanks for your time, Jeff.
All right, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Teachers for Class War. We've been talking to Jeff Duncan Andrade, who's a public school teacher up in Oakland, and our sort of... I don't know. I wish he was my new teacher project mentor, but I don't have that luxury. Anyways, a mentor of sorts. So we're going to move on to a little bit of music, and the Global Local should be in at some point relatively soon. So stay tuned. Ha, ha. Whoa, whoa.
Pasa, pasa, pasa.